nothing in particular not being said on behalf of Tanya Tobias today. Can I just say at this stage that at a meeting that unfortunately, for various understandable reasons, two Thursdays ago, there was an obstacle. We had agreed more or less that I would consult with other members to discuss the need for those who make submissions and anybody else who would agree on this bill, the rate monetary bill, especially on the VAT issue, to be brought back to Parliament to respond to the panel. Ideally, we should have done that today. Both sides should have been here. But I spoke to Tandy. Tandy was in full agreement as well for the ANC committee. So I take it we are in agreement that we need to find a slot very soon when we invite all the participants to have their say on the VAT panel. Bearing in mind also that they are making submissions. I think, Yanga, today was the last day, Isma. You will submit their submissions to us as well, right? I think they're going to say the same thing, but let Parliament hear them directly. Mm-hmm. So we'll do that shortly. Right? We agree on that. Yes, Mr. Mania, Tandy.
I agree with you completely.
Yeah.
Just before we jump in, give us an indication of whether there's an expectation.
You must speak louder. Remember the mic's set up.
I said before the left. Look, basically, Tandy is saying that you can't hear Mr. Mania, which I think is a blessing, Tandy. But since you do want to hear him, fine. All people are to speak in their rally voice. The unfortunate thing is the DA, they don't have rally. Right? So they don't have the rally voice that we have, right? Even
I. That's because the SABC doesn't cover it.
I'm going to wait to congratulate them.
Yeah, no, it's not there anymore. What are you complaining about? Okay, good. Shall we move on? So it's done. We'll do it within 2 weeks. Tebo will have to send a note to us today to find a date. Where is she? Right, of duty, will you remind me, or remind her rather, that we need to send a notice out to all the stakeholders. Good. Right, on the USTEM matter, which I thought I'll deal with at the end, predictably is going to court. They were supposed to appear this morning at 10 o'clock. There are four grounds on which he's objecting, and I don't think I should be saying very much more. The media is being handled by the Speaker's office. I will confer with them, but essentially, we've reached a compromise, and I think they're in judges' chambers now, or they just finished, and the last I know is that he will appear next week on the 5th. And the Parliament lawyers advised the coordinating chair, meaning myself, that it's not worth fighting it in court if he's agreeing to come, and that he needed a few more days. So they tried to give us dates. We said, no, you don't decide the date. We just finally settled, I understand. We will write to everybody this afternoon, and I'm going to arrange a meeting with all the opposition parties together with my co-chairs. We are meeting as co-chairs at 1:15. So we will try to meet with the other parties, say at 9:30 tomorrow, to explain what has happened. Remember, the matter is out of our hands as politicians. It was dealt with by the... I would appreciate if the parties would not issue statements, please. Because that's being handled by the Speaker's office, not by us. That is why I've resisted something like 20 calls and emails and SMSs. Can you please, wait, there'll be a statement issued at 1, please. You know, I should have asked for the meeting to close, you know, with due respect. Can you just... I mean, there will be a short statement issued along these lines. It's not for me to do it. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a speaker, mercifully. It's the Speaker and her office, through the lawyers, will issue a short statement along the lines that he will appear next week, but the whole meeting goes ahead as planned tomorrow. But Rand has agreed to come. Good. Now, Khalid?
One housekeeping matter. The ANC has got a new member.
Ah, yes.
I'll introduce her when she's in. I'm not sure why she's not here. Probably the staff has not told her about, or maybe she doesn't know the venue. So I'll introduce her when
yeah, I was looking at Tracer and explaining
yes.
The venue.
Yeah, that's all.
Okay, thank you all. Can we hand over? We introduce your team, Professor. Or is a doctor? I'm not sure. Yeah.
Thank you, Claire. Claire, can I just check with you? What are our time frames this morning?
Well, normally we often speak for 45 minutes or so at most. But if you need more time, fine, because this is a very, very complex issue for us. We're not technical experts. It's politically very sensitive. We want a speedy resolution now. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So I'm Ingrid Willard. I chaired the VAS subcommittee on behalf of the Data Tax Committee. With me is Dr. Tabi Wioka and Mr. Ayabon Gosawe. And so we've got quite a short presentation. We had hoped it would be on the screen, but apparently that's a constraint. So we do have hard copies. Has everybody got a hard copy of the presentation?
Yes,
they do. Otherwise, we do have more. Thank you. So I'm going to... Are you happy that we take questions as we go, or would you like us to run?
Well,
we'd rather
you give us an overview. Is that correct?
Sure.
Remember?
You can do that.
Yeah.
Is that, huh? I mean, I think possibly we want to take questions of clarification as we go, but if we feel that that's a discussion point rather than clarification, you would rather...
Remember, we're not academics. Right?
Thank you. Thank you, sir. All right? Yes.
But she wants an issue of clarity.
She'll give you an insight.
45 minutes, two sides on one page.
All right. So we won't open that door. Thank you, Chair. We'll then. I'd be surprised if the presentation takes us more than 20 minutes. And so I think
so
that's
take the time. 20 minutes. Yeah. Okay. Remember, we are not technically sophisticated, right?
No, we can't.
So you've got to present it simply and clearly.
Thank you. So just to remind members of what the mandate was for the subcommittee. So we were asked by the Minister of Finance to look at the impact of the VAT increase from 17% to 15% had on households, to assess whether there were ways to mitigate that impact via possibly increasing the number of items on the zero rated list, and to propose ways that one might mitigate the impact on the expenditure side of the budget. Our time frames were extremely limited. The panel was appointed, I was appointed at the end of April, the rest of the panel was appointed, I think, during the course of May, and we then needed to report by the end of July. So. I think we tried to cover those issues, but with varying degrees of depth. So if you look there at the second slide, there's a list there of the members of the panel. So we tried to cover experts from, for example, the Department of Health. Lin-Wen Tsangu is from the Department of Health, so she brought a nutritional perspective. But the panel, for the most part, was made up of economists and tax experts. So if we can move to slide number three, the approach that we took. So we agreed at the outset on some core principles, and I'll return to what those principles were. We took account of submissions that we received from the public. We got approximately 2,000 submissions, 1,400 of those submissions facilitated by Amandla, and for the other 600 submissions all sent individually. So a really massive number of submissions. On the Davis Tax Committee, no other tax discussions solicited anywhere near this number of submissions. On the wealth tax, for example, we got 157 submissions. We thought that was a very large number. But this VAT issue really did resonate with members of the public, and people felt moved to make individual submissions. In addition to those that engaged with the public, we had a meeting at MEDRAC with a social partner. So out of that, we had two meetings with civil society, one in Johannesburg, one in Cape Town, where we had a much more sort of interactive workshop with members of civil society, and we had one additional meeting with some facilitators of MEDRAC as one of the MEDRAC partners. Facilitated by the business corporate. So that's the approach we took. If we go to slide number four, we need to think about the context in which this VAT increase happened. I don't think it was an easy decision for the Treasury to come to increase VAT. It came at a time when they really were very, very pushed for revenue. The VAT as a percentage of the tax mix has been declining somewhat over time, but really we are in a low growth situation where government is struggling for revenue. So we understood that as the context. At the same time, we saw it as our role to try and think about how do we try and reduce some of that impact for our households. So the an important part of that context was also to recognize the fact that South Africa is a highly unequal society. This is not a, one does need to think about tax policy within that framework of recognizing that that we remain one of the most unequal societies in the world. Sorry, actually, number five. Could we turn to slide number five? I think this is quite a useful slide for members just to get a sense of the numbers that we're talking about. So what we have on that slide is we have ranked households from poorest to richest. So we've divided the population up into 10 groups, which are called deciles. And so what you have there are these households are being ranked on the basis of per capita household expenditure. So if we rank households from poorest to richest based on per capita expenditure and then divide them into 10 groups, we can then say, okay, what is the additional amount of money that these households are spending because of the VAT increase? And so if you look at that graph, you'll see that in the poorest decile, the very poorest 10% of households, the VAT increase amounted to about another 105 rand per year that households were needing to spend because of the increase from 14 to 15%. And of course, that's a reflection on the fact that these are incredibly poor households with low levels of expenditure. So that 105 rand makes up about 0.5% of their expenditure. So it may not feel like a large amount in rand terms, but it is a significant proportion of the spending for those households. At the other end of the graph, if you look at the very richest decile, what you see there is in the richest 10% of households, the additional outlay as a consequence of the VAT increase was about another 2,140 rand per year that they were contributing in the form of VAT as a consequence of the increase. And for those households, that increase amounts to about 0.4% of their total spending. So while richer households are contributing much more in rand terms, it's not the case that they're contributing more as a percentage of their income. So for those households, it has a smaller percentage impact on them than it does for poorer households. So we thought that was an important way to think about, to start the discussion about the VAT increase and to see what are we talking about in actual rand terms. Because we come back to this, Tavi will talk about how one might think about the expenditure side of the budget. Are there other ways of compensating those households for this VAT increase, not necessarily through the tax system, but through the expenditure side? Okay, so we turn to slide number six, where we talk a bit about the principles. So the first principle that we as a committee agreed upon is that the tax system should be as progressive as possible. We firmly believe that as part of the country's strategy to reducing inequality, it's incredibly important that the tax system plays a role in reducing inequality. And so we start by acknowledging that even though there is an existing system of zero rating with the 19 items that are already zero rated, that is a less progressive tax than any of the other tax handles. So every person in South Africa pays VAT. That is not true, of course, for something like the personal income tax system, where you have a very progressive system, many people not paying personal income tax at all, and then those that are paying on a steeply increasing marginal tax rate basis. VAT is not like that. VAT impacts every single person in the country. And as a consequence, any increase in VAT will, by definition, make the overall system somewhat less progressive. All right. So that was the first principle. The second principle is that even though we recognize that the tax system as a whole needs to be progressive, and not every tax handle is going to play the same role within the tax system, we nonetheless need to commit to making the VAT system somewhat progressive, and to think about ways in which we can actually increase progressivity, but not in a way which then completely erodes the tax base. And that's the real tension that faces here, is that as you introduce new zero ratings, you're reducing the base, you're reducing overall revenue, and so one needs to think carefully about that tension. And I think members will want to come back to that. So the third principle that we considered to be important was that we need to quantify this. What is the cost of zero-rating additional items? What does it mean for a loss of revenue as we add additional items to the zero-rating list? And because then the question is, of course, going to be, well, if we not getting revenue from the VAT system, then where will the revenue come from? So that's a really important trade-off that, or principle that we need to think about. The fourth one, if we go to that right-hand column, is about ease of administration. And I think this is something we're spending a little bit of time on, because I don't think we necessarily always think about how does this system actually function. And so one of the important principles of zero rating in the VAT system is that you need to ensure that an item is easily identifiable and that there isn't room for avoidance or for misclassification. So if you think about an item such as sanitary towels, right? Sanitary towels, easily identifiable. It's not that the case if you're going to, that there are going to be other goods which are going to be incorrectly classified as sanitary towels, or the sanitary towels are incorrectly classified as other goods. I think that's a clear example where there are no classification problems. But as soon as you get into even something that sounds as simple as bread, right? SARS in the past has spent an enormous amount of time and energy trying to define what exactly is brown bread. So brown bread is currently zero rated. The question is, how brown does a loaf of brown bread have to be in order to be brown? Is this a loaf? Is this a bread roll? Is this, So the classification issues become complicated quite quickly. And so we were conscious of the fact that we would need to ensure that any items that we suggest for addition to the list should be items that can be easily identified both in the legislation and for the retailer who needs to actually implement the system. The fifth principle that we considered is the idea of merit goods. So we were conscious of the fact that we, even though it's not the primary purpose of the VAT system to promote healthy behaviors, one would not want to zero rate items that are considered unhealthy. So, for example, one wouldn't ordinarily think about zero rating alcohol or even sugar. So, in a context where we're thinking about, we've just introduced a sugar tax, it would be inconsistent within government policy to, for example, zero rate sugar, even if it's part of the other tax. And finally, and this is something that we didn't have sufficient time to get into in detail, and it does require more work, is to think about will that benefit of zero rating actually be passed on to consumers? And so that's an important consideration there. Is it the case that if the price, if that is removed from an item, one should see a reduction in the price? But the question is, will that actually happen? Or will some of that price reduction be captured by producers or by retailers? And so that's the framework that we start with. All right, so if we turn to slide number 7, just to talk a little bit about how we approached the issue. So we took a data-oriented approach. We used the most recent data from Statistics South Africa, the Living Conditions Survey, which goes out and interviews households about exactly what they spend. They have a list of 760 expenditure items. And based on that data, you can see exactly what types of foods and non-food items are consumed by poorer households, middle-income households, higher-income households. And so from that data, we can then really get a very clear picture of exactly who buys foods within the country. And so using that data, we can then look for items that are disproportionately consumed by poorer households. So we know that for the most part, poorer households, middle-income households, higher-income households tend to eat the same sorts of items, but perhaps in quite different proportions. So what might be a large part of the food basket of a poorer household might have a smaller share in a higher-income household. So what you're looking for, if you want to ensure that the VAT zero rating disproportionately benefits poorer households, is you need to find items that are consumed, that make up a bigger percentage of the food basket for those households than they do for richer households. So that's not to say that the rand amount won't be bigger in richer households than poorer households. What we're looking at here is what proportion of the spend proportion of the spend for a poorer income household. So then also using that data, we can start to try and look at what would be the overall cost to the fiscus if an item were to be zero rated. So from the living conditions survey, we have an estimate of total spending on a particular item, and we can come to an estimate of what the revenue loss would be. Okay, so that's my short introduction. I'm going to hand over to Ivonka, who's going to talk to you about the findings.
Thank you so much, Prof, and to you, Chair. I think, you know, a starting point for our analysis was to say, if we look at the existing list of zero-rated goods, are they fit for purpose? Do they represent a largely disproportionate number of expenditure for poorer households? And if you look at that graph on slide number 8, you can see that if you stratify households by income into 10 deciles, what you find is that from the poorest, which is decile 1, right through to decile 5, all of those goods that are marked in black, those are the zero-rated goods. And as you can see, the lion's share of the consumption there is in poorer households. So it's quite clear that overall, some of the goods that have been zero-rated do have a progressive impact, and that there's a strong equity gain ratio, which means poorer households consume a much bigger proportion of those goods than relatively richer households would. Now, the other issue then, which complicates things somewhat, relates to the fruit. And some of the vegetables. As you can imagine, there are certain fruits and vegetables that are largely consumed by richer households. And therefore, if you have a catch-all categorization that just says all fruit or all vegetables are zero-rated, you might find that some of those subcategories of fruit and vegetable might not be as progressive as others. So oftentimes, the comparison that's made is between mushrooms and maybe morocco. As you can imagine, if you look at mushrooms, largely the consumption would be skewed towards more richer households in the distribution, and for morocco you would probably see the opposite kind of phenomenon. Now, unfortunately, we didn't have enough time as a panel to go and do that kind of micro and micro level analysis to separate out the products within the existing categories and say within vegetables we ought to take out this one, within fruits we ought to take out another one, and we therefore then suggested that there is a need going forward to explore some of the trade-offs and maybe approach it from a selective perspective. And we certainly didn't make a view known on whether or not that would imply a much greater burden of administration or whether it would make it more easier to administer if we did take that approach. Now, from the submissions that we received, we then whittled down the products to about 66 products for our consideration. We did exclude some where the living conditions survey didn't give us the data. And we made the example there of yogurt. Now, if you look in the block there on the right-hand side, 8 products qualified, in our view, for much more in-depth analysis. And these were baby formula, bread and cake flour, white bread, disposable nappies, poultry, sanitary products and tampons, and school uniform. And I just want to touch briefly on the kinds of tests methodologically that we undertook in order to, what I would say, pass these products through a certain filter to understand whether or not we would make a decision or recommendation on them. I think the first one is it had to be an item that households spend a significant amount on. And for us, that test was about 0.2% of household spending. But in addition to that, there had to be a relatively progressive impact. So if you compare the spending of the first 4 deciles, so the poorest 40% in the households in the income distribution, and you put that over the ratio of the richest households, you needed to have a strong equity gain ratio, which in simple terms said there's a bigger proportion of expenditure on this good by poorer households than there is relatively by the richer households. And then, of course, the other consideration, which was part of our terms of reference, was to say, are there challenges in existing access to expenditure for poorer households, vulnerable households, households that are headed by women, and other vulnerable and disadvantaged groups? And more importantly, is it a merit good? So is it a kind of good that you would want to encourage more consumption of? Of course, as part of existing government policy or even in order to leverage some of the positive externalities or spillovers that expenditure or consumption of those goods has. And examples of those kind of goods would be sanitary pads, it would be books, it would be school uniforms, and all manner of other products that, as a society, we want to encourage much greater consumption of. Now, for each of the products that we reviewed, and of the eight that we shortlisted today, if I can use that term, we looked at the incidence by each household decile. So we looked at decile one, what is the incidence of the tax in question, so the 15%, what is the percentage that is paid by each household decile. We also then looked at whether or not we can clarify the definition of a specific product. Can you delineate it in a way that allows you to be able, one, to monitor compliance and enforce compliance, but also that would give you the kind of ease of administration. Now, I want to mention this because it does become important in one of the products that that we have recommended here. Then the other consideration was a socioeconomic justification. Are we able to justify that greater expenditure of a particular good is going to have positive socioeconomic spillovers or a positive socioeconomic impact? And then I think the last one there for me is also the cost to the fiscus based on sales data and using that as a proxy for household expenditure. What is it going to cost the fiscus by way of foregone revenue or revenue that ought to have gone into the fiscus if you do generate it? Now, of course, there was quite a lot of debate within the panel, and I must say that of the 66 goods that we had, and even of the 8 that we did whittle list down to, that there were some goods where there was unanimous agreement that we ought to recommend the zero rating of those goods. And I want to touch on those first before I get to some of the other ones where there was a bit more debate and a bit more deliberation on, and less agreement, I should say. Let me start with the unanimous recommendations. I think as a panel, when it comes to cake and bread flour and even white bread, despite some nutritional concerns, there was a unanimous agreement that if you look at the expenditure patterns, least of all of lower income households, that this was one we ought to be recommending for zero rating because it passed the methodological test that we had. But moreover, we felt that there was a progressive impact, in particular for much poorer households, that in a way did offset some of the nutritional concerns that we had. And in the case of white bread, I think already there's you know, some strides that have already been made by the government to fortify some of that bread to just offset some of the nutritional concerns that there are. I think another product which certainly we had unanimous agreement on, although it didn't pass strictly some of the methodological tests that we had, was the sanitary products. Now, one of the things that we found, and I guess this is by nature of you know, the conditions in that market, was that this was a product that was largely consumed by women who are relatively in higher income households. And the reason for that could potentially be that it's largely inaccessible for women in the lower deciles, and therefore you're not going to see those kinds of expenditures at the bottom end. Now, we felt it important that this is one of the merit goods, very important to women and girls, and that despite this being a progressive measure of zero rating, it wasn't going to be enough to ensure access. Because if I can't access sanitary pads at the existing VAT at 14% or even 15%, and if it comes to about 15 rand, if you do take out the VAT, it doesn't necessarily mean if it goes to 10 rand, I'll still be able to access it. And so this is the one where we felt there needed to be complementary direct expenditure interventions to ensure access, least of all for those who access wouldn't be possible, even if you did zero rate it. The other one which was contentious, and I want to go back to the point we made earlier on about the definitional clarity, and that was school uniforms. We felt that it was a highly progressive one. It passed some of the methodological tests that that we put it through, and it was important to improve school access, which is something that I think as a society we're interested in the positive externalities that come from encouraging much greater participation in the schooling system and in the educational system more broadly. But of course there are definitional issues. Now, many of us in the room are wearing white shirts. Now, there would be a question of saying, if you include white shirts as part of school uniforms to be zero-rated, are you able to target some of the beneficiaries for that? So is there a difference between me going out and getting a white T-shirt and somebody who's of similar size to me, who's of school-going age, also getting the same T-shirt? And so for us, that was the one where we felt this one ought to be considered if we are able to address some of the definitional issues. And of course, in addition to that, we did suggest that there ought to be a basic school uniform, I hate to call it a kit, or a basic sort of school uniform that ought to be targeted for this purpose, and things like blazers shouldn't be placed for consideration, but basic things like shoes, grey pants, tunics, and school shirts as part of a basic school uniform package ought to be considered for this one. When it comes to nappies, we found that this was a progressive one, particularly for women and children, but also for some disabled and elderly people and those in our society who are vulnerable, who are unable to assist themselves in this manner, and we felt that this one ought to be included, and this is not just nappies for young children, but even adults as well. And when it comes to some of the considerations around the benefit and the cost, we found that of the suggested items that we had here, that the estimated relief for the poorest 70% of households, so that's decile 1 through to decile 7, would be about 2.8 billion rand. Now, it's also helpful to compare that 2.8 billion rand to how much the fiscus would gain from the total increase of the VAT from 14% to 15% in the absence of any additional zero rating. So if we kept the 19 goods as they are, and we didn't add any new goods, there would be about a benefit of 3.1 billion rand to the fiscus. Now, if we look at the data for sales of some of these specific products, the cost in terms of revenue foregone for the value-added tax system is sitting at around 4 billion rand. Now, that is about 17% of the total anticipated income from the increase of the VAT by about 23 billion rand. So if you look at that 4 billion rand in relation to the 23 billion rand that is expected to go into the fiscus as a result of that tax change that came in February, then it does give some perspective and some context. Just a last one on the product where I think there was there wasn't really unanimous agreement, and where there was some debate. And I think let me maybe start off with baby formula, and I'll come back to the individually quick frozen chicken parts. So this was one that did pass some of our methodological tests, but it was important for us to consider where existing government policy is in this regard, so that you don't have a situation where our suggestion actually leads to some policy incoherence when it comes to this particular issue. We did recognize that for some babies where the mothers have to go to work or the mothers are unable for whatever reason to breastfeed and require some form of supplementary nutrition or there are some challenges in terms of the transmission of HIV from mother to child, that it becomes an important thing to have expenditure on baby formula. But I think the input that we did receive from nutritional experts was that there are challenges when it comes to baby powder. And of course, existing government policy is aimed at encouraging much greater breastfeeding. And then of course, there are other environmental and context-specific challenges that might make this one difficult. I think the first one is around challenges when it comes to the quality of water in many of the areas where some of these households in decile 1 through to 7, I would say, are living. But also, I think one of the suggestions we made here was to say government ought to be considering on the expenditure side how to ensure that we make in targeted households where breastfeeding is not a possibility, how do we ensure that there is access to that baby formula. And therefore, as a panel, we felt that we ought not to be proposing or recommending this one through the zero rating side of things, but where there's a sense of a need and there's a targeted intervention that should be done on the expenditure side. Let me come back to the issue of IQF chicken. Certainly within the panel there were very strong views in support of and against the zero rating of IQF. And let me start off with some of the arguments for doing this. I think it's well established that IQF chicken, in particular these frozen parts, are a staple for low-income households, alongside many other sub-products in the poultry value chain. I think of chicken feet, chicken heads, chicken skins. And, of course, the challenge then becomes, how do you ensure that if this is a staple food and it's a staple protein for many low-income households, how do you ensure that there's much greater access, alongside balancing the consideration that this is a sector that certainly for the lower end of the product line, is very important intensive. I think also the other methodological test that we did pass this product through alongside others, certainly passed that test, and of course some argued for IQF chicken parts that the definition within the industry is standard, and therefore there are no definitional issues that would introduce challenges when it comes to ease of administration. Now, in terms of the arguments against it, many argued that the definition wasn't rigorous enough to, and of course, they would run the risk of including other poultry products or finding that some of the producers would actually switch from, say, fresh chicken through to a frozen IQF parts. Now, also, there was a sense that if we compare this particular product to some of the other products that we have, be it sanitary towels, school uniform, or even some of the flours that we've suggested, that relatively this was a high-cost product to the fiscus. And the other issue then, of course, was a market structure issue which related to imports. And if you did zero rate this, or if you suggested zero rating, would it add or would it de facto lead to subsidizing imports? Because if you look at IQF products and if you look at that market structure, by and large, many of the households who are consuming at the bottom end of the distribution are consuming products that come from import value chains. But in addition to that, the suggestion was that this was one of the products where potentially you could consider some of the relief or some of the benefits coming through the expenditure side, rather than, in essence, trying to subsidize or even create more demand channels for imports. And the sense was that the existing nutritional programs of the government ought to be complemented and supplemented in a manner that would be able to address the challenge here, which is some of the stunting, malnutrition that we see at a household level and many of the other nutritional challenges that we see there. Let me pause there for a second and allow my colleague, Dr. Lyoka, to continue.
Good morning, everyone. So I'll be talking about the alternatives to zero rating. What Ingrid and Ayabonga spoke about was more on the tax revenue side. And so obviously we had to think about ways in which we can tap into the expenditure side as an alternative. It wasn't very easy, and also considering the limitations of the budget. I think as a starting point, and I know this from what the public has said, there is a belief that zero rating is a be-all and end-all. And I then often ask people, even following up from what Ayabonga has said about certain products, how many fruits and vegetables do you think the poor consume? And when I asked even a lot of people, it was less than 5 fruits and less than 5 vegetables. And how many fruits and vegetables do the wealthy or those in the upper income deciles consume? So you tend to consume, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, peas, beans, the fancier vegetables and fruits, strawberries and cherries. So when you zero rate a fruit and vegetable, you're zero rating not just products that are only consumed by the poor. You're zero rating all products. So as also Professor Ingrid has mentioned, but zero rating all products, the benefit goes to those who can afford more than those who can't afford. And so that's why in the slide we said zero rating is a blunt instrument because it cuts costs across all products of households, not just the poor. And in theory, it could compensate the poor through expenditure programs. And we looked at providing products, so in kind, or also cash transfers, which equal to the cost of VAT. So the challenge here is obviously reaching all poor households affected by VAT with sufficient resources to offset the tax impact. And also administrative and fiscal difficulty of scaling up both in kind and cash programs on a sufficient scale. To date, the government has been unable to expand in-kind programs to ensure comprehensive coverage. So if you look at transfer of goods and services, the government transfers a large share of tax revenue to the poor amongst other through nutritional support. That's, you know, subsidizing homes, greater subsidies to education in low-income areas, public employment schemes, and free health care and for low-income families. So you can using income support programs to mitigate the impact of VAT increase on the poorest 50% would require an expansion of these products, these programs. So by 1.8 billion above the amount they have grown in any case. So a measure, for instance, by the MTE projections, and in ways that would ensure virtually all households in the poorest 7 deciles to benefit. The other one that we looked at, an example of an in-kind program, would be the National School Nutritional Support Program, which reaches about 9 million learners in poor communities. Currently costs about 6.4 billion. This would have to increase by about a third to compensate the poorest 50% of households. It's a huge increase in expenditure or money that would go to in-kind programs. And this would obviously include households without school-going children or where the program does not exist. I know Ibonga spoke about a sanitary towel, and what we then also did was, because sanitary towels, again using the same examples of fruits and vegetables, by zero rating sanitary towels, you're really just benefiting, again, the people who can afford it. So we further recommended that the government provide sanitary towels for free to poor communities. So this would be an example of an in-kind program. There may be obviously administrative costs to that, but I think that it would deal with the sanitary towel problem, and the sanitary towels were very popular in terms of the requests from both the public and business communities, NGOs. The other example is cash transfers. Government has programs to register poor households, notably for social grants, UIA, and PAYE. I may add here that when we spoke to especially civil society organizations, they did mention that we assume that, yes, government does provide these programs to the registered poor. The problem is there are children and that aren't registered, and so that do not have an ID. So what happens to them? So here, only social grants provide payments to most registered households. The system does not indicate households' income or expenditure, so it would require substantial reforms to enable compensation equal to the cost of the VAT increase per household. Also, household expenditure patterns vary substantially. So providing an average refund would overcompensate for some and also undercompensate for others. So informal workers and self-employed people do not pay either UIF or taxes, so they would not be included in these systems. Most, however, belong to households to get some kind of, you know, we want them to get some kind of social grant. I may add here as an example, it didn't feature in our report, but we looked at, I did investigate other ways of using the expenditure, and I looked at Brazil, which is something that we discussed, but we felt that it didn't quite fit into the South African example, or we did actually speak about it, but we never really quite implemented it. And in the Brazilian case, so they have social grant system that is similar to ours. Actually, they've been very successful in alleviating poverty and also reaching out to as many people as possible who require these social grants. But theirs comes with a condition. So women are given money, women because they tend to be the ones that look after children. So they're giving money by the state, but on condition that they send their kids to school and also their kids go for regular health checkups. And I guess the spirit of this is that you then don't have you don't have the education, you know, the drop-off level that we do see in our education system. And if your child doesn't go to school, you don't get the social grant. The other thing is that the health, it then deals with the health issue, so you don't put a burden on the health system because you get money on condition that your child is taken for health checks. But again, I think that, as Ingrid has mentioned, that look, it's not, we've discussed it in South Africa for many years now, and there may be issues in terms of administrative costs. Who's going to administer that? Who's going to ensure that the parent takes the child to school or the parent takes the child to get regular health checks? The other example in the cash transfer option is obviously the UIF. In theory, the UIF system registers all workers earning under 180,000 a year, so could provide a conduit for cash transfer, but in practice only 1.7 million actually contribute. So it's likely that most very low wage informal and domestic workers are excluded, and also systems are not designed to make payments for all members. So it's not entirely ideal. So just in conclusion, we cannot as a society seek to extend the tax base by increasing the burden on per household because of South Africa's unusually large inequality. But any effort to mitigate the cost of that for the poor will cost the fiscus. And I think here is that I often say, look, I don't, given our financial constraints, increasing VAT is not necessarily a bad thing. Where it's a bad thing is that if it's not directed to the poor who need it. So if it was going towards alleviating poverty, going to schools, building schools, infrastructure development, hospitals in the very communities that are very vulnerable, then we'd have less of a debate in terms of why did we increase that if that money is channeled to the very people that require the help. That increase will cost poor households as a group by around 3 billion. Offsetting the cost is difficult because households differ in different in expenditure patterns and needs. So zero rating is administratively easier to implement, but at least in theory harder to target than transfers to households in cash or in kind. Thank you.
Are you done?
Thank you, Jeff.
Okay, yes. Over to Linda. Yeah, Tani.
Chair, I don't know how much time I have. Because this is one of the questions we should have given more time to engage experts in terms of the models they utilize to come to this conclusion. First, let me say upfront, I'm not necessarily for this, but we're trying to bring solutions to the difficult aspect that we find ourselves. First, let me appreciate the research that suggests that certain products are not necessarily beneficial to the poor. I want to argue for those ones first before I even get to the gist of the net. And one of them is baby formula. For instance, what you should have argued further is that you find instances that inter African water is mixing and women use water which is having a base of mercury in rural areas, and we know the effects of mercury in the health system and what challenges that. So those health experts should have argued on those bases against subsidizing the formula. In actual fact, as part of the health program, we should be encouraging them to breastfeed because that's the best way for growth of a child where I come from. That's how I was inducted. So I would never encourage any woman to depend on formula. And if at all we want to look at a targeted approach towards that, we need to be specific what type of formulas and how government can provide for that to bring relief. I don't know which women I will be bringing relief to because rural women breastfeed. That's what they do. So the relief will not be benefiting the poor in this instance. So I will not even want to speak about that. And I'm happy you also agreed in a way with some of us about which type of products to zero rate. And one of them, the chair is very keen to speak about this specific food I'm trying to eat here today, kiwi. you know, I don't even know whether it's some households in rural areas know what is a kiwi. I remember seeing green pepper for the first time in Denmark in 1997, and I argued that there's no product like that in South Africa. And the South African pulled me aside and said, no, this grows in South Africa. So I've never seen a green pepper before. I only saw it in 1997, and I'm honest about it. Now, we need to classify those specific products. And I'm happy that you came and unanimously to the conclusion of Silent Habib Tower. Because in my previous life in a youth organization, we used to say government must provide them for free.
Yeah.
So finally we have come, and Bosha Tilelo, where she is as an ambassador, she'll be very happy if she hears that the battle has been won finally, that sanitary pads are going to be provided for free. But you seem to have a different outcome in relation to what's going to be the benefit of the fiscal. You say if you compare, there will be 4 billion for gone to the fiscal, but there will be 23 billion that will come into the fiscal. I want clarity on that one. Because we need to understand what is the cost-benefit analysis that has been made in relation to what the fiscal will gain when we implement this 1%. Okay? So if you can, and I know there's been limitations in terms of time frame for you to come to this finding, but one of the interesting graphs, and it's going to be the determinant for how to reach this, is the graph where you show the benefits of poverty. And this is going to be the determinant for us to come to a conclusion whether there's a need for us to go the option of zero rating, for us to be able to get in the medium term the revenue needed. But one aspect that should be very clear, and maybe National Treasury has not, when it gave you this task, explained that the intention is to have it in the medium term, not in the long term. Because once it is that case, we are not going to support it. We are supporting it as an immediate measure to address a specific fiscal period, and beyond that, we're hoping for a different solution. So if it's not being juxtaposed to that understanding, then it's going to be a challenge. When it relates to targeted interventions in relation to transfers in kind, I thought the Commission was going to suggest a model. And I'm happy that you are speaking about the Brazilian model, because when we were talking, I was thinking about how Cubans deal with issues of health. In Cuba, if you've got a deadly disease, you are quarantined until you are healthy. So it's not an issue of the administrative cost, it's an issue of management. Of if you put a policy imperative, how you manage it is the solution, not necessarily the administrative cost, but how you put a law that will make sure that you achieve the intended. Because if you have this XTR-TB and you discharge yourself from hospital, the possibilities that you're going to infect 100 more people in your community, because we don't have policies that is quarantined to you as an individual to be able to make you healthy, not even to at the cost to government. So it's about how from the onset you are able to check the person's health situation, starting from young children. How many do we know have HIV, have chronic diseases, to a point that how do we check where they are, how we administer medicines to them, and probably what type of programs we put them to keep them healthy, to live longer. So to me, it's not about the tool that we want to impose in terms of revenue collection. It's more about how we administer many other issues that are related to that, which at some point we might speak to them. Chair, there is also two things that have been suggested, that tax system as a whole should be progressive, but you did not say how should we do it. So can you make suggestions to us? Because we agree in principle that this one is an unprogressive one, but how then do we have a mixed basket to be able to remove burden from one type of tax system? For instance, in the South African context, recently we moved from the company tax, which did not yield much result, to a less than 10% isn't it, in what we collected, because we established that those rich households are not significant in the South African context for you to be able to collect enough. And when you do PIT in itself, it was not also helpful. The workers were not happy. And what other tools do you utilize? So how do you then have a mixed custom? Because you said as a whole, you have to specifically speak to the work that you spoke to. I just want to look at one issue, Chair. The chicken issue. In my previous life, I used to work for the DTI, and we had what is still a bone of contention between South Africa and America, the abort, where Americans wanted to import what we call meat on bone in South Africa. So if you look at the IQF meat product, they're actually more import than locally produced product. Now, once you go this route, you're going to actually increase your import, and you're not going to benefit your infant industry. So maybe this is where you should have suggested a targeted approach. The township where I come from, people will not prefer to eat a chicken breast. They will prefer to eat maldoan. Now this thing, we need not to be punitive to the extent that we remove everything, but be targeted to say, let's look at what those low-income households consume on a daily basis. They don't eat a full portion of chicken during the week. That's not at all. It doesn't, okay. They will eat Malkwana Lito, and then probably it becomes a luxury to have a full. Actually, if you look at the price of a 2 kg, I made it my business to go and check. I was shocked that it's 82 rand, 2 kg. And in that, there's salt water, which comprises more than 20% of brine that has been injected into that to make it look proportional. So there's no nutritional value of the IQF product if you want to go the route of zero rating. So you will have to look at that. I don't know, Chair, because I don't know whether the Commission got more time, because I wanted to come to an issue where we talk about what is a merit good, which should be there as part of the nutritional program for young children. For instance, I don't see why a child can't consume an apple a day. Whether do we do it through our nutritional program systems, or maybe the suggestion that you might want to give to us, so that when it comes, we say we don't have to buy it from a shop, but daily we can, there will be a proviso that government will provide an apple a day for a child at school level. Then we will know that we will not have dealt with the problem of giving those who afford to give a pistachio the opportunity to say, because the pistachio is nutritional, because it is. But I mean, it's very expensive. It's a different type of a nut that I can't even afford to consume on a daily basis. Now, these are the things. Chair, let me come back to... Oh, I want you to suggest a support program beyond the ones we have, those in kind. Because the other day I went to ShopRite and I was trying to find out whether are they prepared to have a program where people use a card system to buy. And the lady did not have a clue what I was going to talk about. I was very disillusioned. Yeah, because I believe that's where we should be going to. Because it will give you specific products that you can only purchase with them. So we give a poor person a card. We say, this is your allocation for the whole month. But when they go to a store, they know which specific product can only be purchased with that card. So, That and Mom, I know I've never suggested this before, but I'm throwing ideas there, because I don't know how we're going to explain to all of these people what we're trying to do here and so on. So basically those are the things that I believe we should start moving towards to be able to identify potential relief on the expenditure side. But thank you very much for touching to many things that you believe are progressive. I know we have really good time, but we're able to help us in one way or the other to come to an idea where we should be going. But we need a concrete suggestion. I know you are avoiding it. for obvious reasons, but Professor, you are the people who know better than us. You can tell us right in our faces whether we should abandon the course or not. But if you say you just suppose you use 23 billion in the system, then I like the idea. I don't know. People are not going to like me for that. But it's going to have an immediate effect to our education program, because as we speak, NAPSAS will not be having take-ins for the next financial year, given the challenges that we have. And that has been reported already. And for us to be able to have take-ins for the next financial year, we need immediate solutions. Now, as we start the money bill, we should declare where this is the direction. Thank you very much.
Colleagues, I'm sure we all agree that it's very rational that we allow the panel to respond and no further questions.
Well,
by the time the panel responds, it'll be 4 o'clock, right?
I didn't mean
so
to
no more questions. Hands up, those of you who are here. Lucky I see you. Okay, Mr. Lee, you are not Tandy, okay? You don't have the same rights as Tandy.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you've made that clear many times. To Willard and the team, thank you very much for the work that you've done on the subject. Clearly the increase of 1% in VAT was an unpopular move, and your work, as I understand it, was to try and mitigate the impact of that 1% increase on the poor, and I would suggest the bottom five debt now. So, if that is the case, you lost at some stage in your presentation. You say that the cost to those poor, and I assume the bottom decile, will be 3 billion rand.
Seven decile.
Thank you. That's good to know. So it's a bigger grouping than so. For 7 deciles, there's a cost of 3 billion rand. So the 1% increase in VAT in those 7 deciles will cost 3 billion rand. Does that 3 billion rand include, for instance, the additional cost in school food feeding schemes? So in other words, what are the limitations in arriving at that 3 billion? If one assumes then that the 3 billion is the cost to the poorer, the 7 deciles, the measures that you recommended for those 7 deciles, how much do they amount to? Do they amount to 3 billion rand, less or more? So that's the kind of nub of the matter, as far as I'm concerned, is that we try to find measures to mitigate against the 1% increase. And the measures you're recommending, do they meet that objective? And how do they compare with the total cost to the fiscus? So if the total cost to the fiscus of your recommendations amounts to a figure which I'm not sure of, and the cost to the poor is 3 billion, then there's a consequence of your measures which is something more than was intended, unintended consequence. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Mania?
Thank you. I wonder if you could just give us the total cost of your recommendations. My back of the envelope calculation says it's somewhere between, about 12.2 billion. So that's, what is the total cost of your package of recommendations? And the second point is, in your submission, you estimate the cost of that foregone would be 4 billion. My question put to the Treasury is, do you concur with that calculation? I imagine that you don't, given the fact that you have a different methodology. Thank you.
Colleagues,
Oh, thanks, Chair. Good morning. Chair, I'm going to probably phrase my question in the form of an analogy. So I want to speak to the issue of school uniform. So I'm currently filled up with getting a school uniform for next year, you see. So my son is going to grade one, so I'm one hell of an excited chap. And I'm just asking myself, Chair. And Chair, so in the midst of that excitement, I'm asking myself, how many times a year does one buy school uniform? What's the relief of this? Because I'm looking at the poor. Because, January and then when? Suppose you replace maybe later on in the year. So I'm trying to get to a point, Chair, to say, how much does this actually assist the poor? Because for me, this intervention was to assist the poor. And why I raise it in that way, Chairperson, I want to go to the issue of sanitary towels. And Mam Tandi, please don't take this to be any... it's got no malice on the argument you advance. But, so whether there's a VAT increase or no VAT increase, those who can't afford still can't afford. I think that's what we're talking about. So then what's the point? Because we still have not addressed the plight of the poor. That zero rating will not decrease the cost to the poor. I hate to put it, Chair, there's a whole narrative in the country about how condoms are free and therefore sanitary towels are free. And I probably agree with that for those school children who come from poor backgrounds, cannot afford them and have to miss 5 days in a month and therefore about on average 50 days in a year of school. That I agree with. But those who afford, I'm trying to be balanced as to who does this intervention assist. Because, Chair, even if you do have your free condoms, as we say, those that can afford will go and still buy their high-end condoms. So this intervention, I'm offering it in the most layman terms as possible, because I'm trying to understand what on a month-on-month for a poor household, this zero, and it would be regrettable if, because the term was that was used, or that it was very popular, I think that's the term that was used. I doubt this was an exercise done to respond to popular sentiment. It was an exercise done to deal with the very real issues facing people. So I'd just like to be clarified to that, on that rationale, Chairperson. I'm glad that the issue of Brazil has been raised, because I had here written the role of SASA in all of this. We've got 17 million people on social grounds. And somehow I'm of the view that SASA cannot just be dispensing money. It needs to look at a broader basket, as the thing has been articulated, of how that money has an impact for people. So I think maybe more work still needs to be done there. So I'm in full agreement with that. Chair, I think we must, the fact that I think the one comment was that not enough time was had, and that is regrettable, and probably then more work still needs to be done. Chair, then we speak about school uniform in a school kit, to use the term cautiously. By the time we arrive at the norms and standards of what the school kit would look like, the impact would have already hit the poor. So what I'm trying to get at, Chair, because I want to be really, really honest, Chair, I don't take any comfort in the items that have been listed here that they will actually go the whole nine yards. I just don't. And I think that, as has been said, that more work still needs to be done. So I'm trying to get a sense with the Commission. What was the short-term, medium-term, and long-term intervention, right? These are the things which we can do much. and then develop a school kit, and then develop that. But what's the immediate relief? Because as far as I see it, we are still in the main, still stuck with 19 items on the list. I just feel, Chair, with petrol increases month on month, a VAT increase, and so the cost really being borne by the poor here is really, really high. And I don't get a sense. All of this is very good. I take nothing from the commission. Absolutely, I think they've done a very thorough job, and I applaud them for that. I don't think it's an easy exercise either. But I want to put probably all of us in the shoes of the poor. This is all high-level interventions, which will take a very long time. And by the time we arrive at those interventions, we have left a trail of destruction behind of people who will be swimming in conditions of poverty in a manner which none of us can appreciate. So I've raised what I wanted to raise in a spaghetti form of way, but I really hope that the things I'm saying are addressed. School uniform is a once-off item per year in the main. So I'm really hoping, Prof, take us through your short-term, medium-term, and long-term interventions so that at least we can tell people something is wagalai. But at this point, we're speaking in very high-level terms, which in the main, these benefits. Because now my nappy is lower, I know me coming from a rural area, one gogo said she has told the kid she does not want these disposable nappies because, one, they cause a problem for where she throws them away, because we're living in conditions which are, you know, the refuse collection is not reality. So Ukoko prefers that you go and buy child nappies and they'll be washed and they hang along the line. So none of my interventions, like, can we put ourselves in the shoes of the practical realities of the people? Thanks, Chair.
Okay, yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also join the colleagues who have spoken before and welcome and congratulate the Commission for the work well done. And my colleague here, you don't have to put me in the shoes of the poor because I'm there. I've grown
strong.
Yeah. So I know everything that you're speaking about. What I appreciate most, I think, Che, let me first start by saying we need to start somewhere. As much as we criticize and try to come up with inputs while we are happy with the work that we have done so far, at least we know where we are going. We have started somewhere. And what makes me happy is that the work is biased towards the poor. The focus is towards the poor, because that's where our problem is. Chair, I also wanted to speak on the issue of uniform. My colleague here asked how many times per year. But my question will be, how many shares do you buy per year? Because it should be a pack per year. Such things. A JSC, because you can't just buy, you know, trousers, shoes and things. For winter also, we need to cover that. But also, I wanted to check if are we going to have a tool to identify where this child is from. Is this child from a private school or a public school? Because according to me, we need to cover the poor who cannot afford, who are in a public school and not those in a private school, to give that relief. I don't know. So I also wanted to be assisted. I'm not a nutritional specialist. I'm not a tech specialist like Mazambani and my learned comrades.
Oh,
I'm just asking from a layman's point of view, what nutritional value do we have in a white bread than in a brown bread? Because I see here we're talking about white bread. And in my household, I'm discouraging white bread. I don't know. I need to be assisted. And when I see my dietitian, she recommends that I eat brown bread. So what is the nutritional value? Why do we recommend white bread rather than a brown bread? Or maybe why do we just not say bread? What will be the difference? Because if also when you say bread, there will be those who will be preferring, or they are used to having those special breads rather than in a special way, not the ordinary Albani and Fasco bread. So we need to be careful. The baby formula, I don't know. I'm happy that you say you have made this consultation. I'm just not sure to what extent, because you say there were even written submissions. The poor, because as a parliament, we are parliament of the people. And in most cases, people who are able and who have access to parliament are the people who are able, the rich, who can fly, who can have access to internet and information, to know that this is the time that I should make submission and all those things. I don't know. Maybe it was raised in NADLEG, because I know Labour is represented there. That there is this problem that has been there before. In my previous lab that we have raised, Comrade Nsewa, I think you remember, in COSATU, that we do agree and appreciate that the country is encouraging mothers to breastfeed because it's healthier than anything. But what if you are a working mother? You know, to have those facilities for baby what? For you to be able to see your baby, to be where you're working, to take care of
early childhood.
Yes. At the workplace, so that you can have an access to your baby to breastfeed. Such things need to be considered, and I think this is something which is good, which is going to make sure or to make the government to have intergovernmental relations, because there are many role players and they have to make sure that I'm so happy. This is a victory to me. I 150% support you if there's such a thing. I said I'm not a mathematician, I'm not a statistician, I'm not a financial person. But then I'm so excited. I fully support you. Because I remember I even raised this chair, if you remember, when we were debating. The sanitary towels need to be free. And I'm talking from experience. And if I heard you clear when you were presenting, you said you're recommending that it should be free. And I'm so excited. You have just made my day. Because looking at the experience that one had, it's not only about losing your time at school, but also health-wise. What we have experienced in our time, it's not okay. And this government, being government of the people, should be biased to the poor, and for the people, the health of the people is very important. I'm very excited about this one, Chair. And I'll leave other issues. I'm just so happy. Thank you.
Ms. Lee, and then Nancy. I know Mr. Lane is already on.
just briefly, in addition to my
and Peggy,
in addition to my question the terms of reference requested you to evaluate the current list of zero rated food items and then eventually that non-food items. Doesn't appear that you've made any recommendations about possibly lifting the zero rat rating on any of the existing items. Why is that? That's the first question. The second question is just the methodological. In considering the inclusion for additional items, well, methodology seems to have relied on public submissions. In other words, you've got public submissions, and then you identified 66 products based on those public submissions, which you then evaluated. So it doesn't appear to me that you've evaluated, that you've, I use this term godly, rigorously evaluated what products poor households actually require. What you've done is you've taken some public submissions based on what people believe, and perhaps some experts believe what poor households require, and you proceeded from there, which would seem to me to be a methodological flaw, unless I misunderstand your methodology.
Okay, and now to you, know your next.
Of course, I haven't forgotten. Thank you very much, and good morning.
Good morning, sir.
A beautiful
coffee.
Yeah,
don't be chauvinistic in ethnic.
No, thank you very much. Mine is a very brief intervention, really. But I would like to welcome this excellent piece of research work, really. I'm really fascinated by it and so on. But I think there are points that we should actually be on the lookout for. One of which is the whole question of, I think, the previous interventions that have been made. I like the intervention made by the name Ntandazo Mkhulelo. Yes, yes. I like the interventions that he made, because basically in the process of conducting this work, we should also be measuring the extent to which we make this valuable kind of a contribution in mitigating the impact of the VAT increase on the poor. I think essentially that's what the point is. But the second point, Chair, that I would like to also put across is that I think we should also be careful not to be bogged down around the issue of definition. Because, you know, I think we should also accept that it's not going to be possible to cover each and every particular aspect in dealing with definitions. I mean, a white shirt student prints, for an example, from PEP, you know, for purposes of a school uniform. Yes, it's a white shirt, but it's specifically designated for schooling purposes and so on. It's not the same thing as going into whether Woolworths or printing shop and so on and get a white shirt there and so on. Similarly, also with regards to the issue of bread and to what extent to define yourself around that and so on. I think we should look at a codified approach that takes into account, you know, the totality of the situations that we're trying to deal with. If you want to zero rate a brown bread, you rather have a broader definition that talks to all products, for instance, that are made of, you know, brown flour, you know, as opposed to brown bread, bread rolls, a brown roti, and so on and so forth. And so forth. So it's, you're not going to make sufficient progress if you take that approach. So my suggestion is that around the issue of definitions, let's recognize two things. One, I'm going to cover each and every particular aspect, but secondly, that I think let us be broad-based in our approach. But thanks very much for this.
Again, Chair, you must tell this honorable member that in Japan they wanted a school, a Guji, to develop school uniform.
Yeah.
So you can imagine how much it was going to be. So you understand why they've gone this way.
Thank you very much. Let me also add my voice by appreciating the presentation that has been made. Maybe mine will be directed to National Treasury. There was a submission by one of the organizations that said maybe we may implement this VAT increase, 1% VAT increase, for a period of only one financial year. Is that possible? Is it reversible? Is this decision reversible? That is my question. And again, Chair, I also want to add my voice by saying I don't really believe that we should add white flour products, let me say so, with regards to zero rating. I think it becomes a choice of a consumer, you know, that you decide to buy a white bread. We really appreciate this, the mention of sanitary towels, a zero rating of sanitary towels. It's something that we have been fighting for quite a long time, especially us from the side of the ANC Women's League. You know, we are for the, free supply of sanitary towels, and we really appreciate this intervention. Thank you very much.
Okay, you want to
do
like
the
input to the
poor. Yeah.
Oh, yes, of course.
Just a quick one. I'll take my tongue out of my cheek. Jim, I'm not sure who should answer, whether the panel or National Treasury. What I wanted to some clarity on is the panel presumably has a life. Has the panel's life now come to an end? And what has been the cost of the panel?
I expected this one.
So those of you who don't know, the visitors, this is Dimitani Yancy. He's from
From
the Parliamentary Budget Office. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, I just have a quick one. It seems to me that the panel had a lot of litigation to do with competing issues. So I was saying that it's obviously clear from what I've seen that the panel had a lot of navigation to do around so much competing issues, fiscal objectives, healthcare issues, and equity issues, given time as well, it's quite uninteresting. Then on the 25th of April, during public hearing, I think there were two things that were raised by the state. I think the one was, one of the things, there were a lot of issues, but one of the two things that came out was that the limiting scope of the panel was too strong, the panel from doing comprehensive recommendations to the minister. Has that in that limitation, I think one of the points was the fact that the fiscal framework was not approved, as I think the community mentioned that, as a result, there's so much limited scope to work within. Raise this point that it dealt with so that when public hearing comes, the funding is given the parliament input into that. And the second point was the predetermined outcome. One of the public hearing submissions was that they have already been predetermined outcome. The process was just going to follow the predetermined outcome. I think they decided to say the outcomes of the DTC reports, they don't the outcomes will already come through. It's going to be a predetermined work. So I'd like the panel to comment on that as well. Quick issue that the question I ask as well, when we get the alternative you mentioned transfers and so on, but I think I just want to ask whether you also look at there are those beneficiaries who don't fall in the transfer, the social guard and so on. You look into those, I mean, there's so much young, unemployed, even older unemployed people, and look at how can those benefit within these courses and how can that come as part of your organization there. There were also part of the limitation also I see was the 4 billion potential that's going to go on. The question I was going to ask was there sort of a threshold that you're working on to say you can't go beyond this, you have to work between these boundaries or just work through without necessarily a threshold. Obviously that will also channel the panel's work to be saying, I mean, I'm ignorant of the time issue yet, I'm just mentioning the time in terms of how much government will afford to go from kind of beyond this level or can go below certain level and so on. So I'm going to say that as well. Look at the list of submissions. And look at the eight products that we also recommend there. The committee just a simple format, the rationale there, you know. So see some of the items were not necessarily highlighted in the list, but I understand that those who lose the patents will be published something. So just give a rationale how you made it too. To see the list, the products that are not there, but they're coming out here, and also looking at the benefits of measures which are quite low and give a rationale around there. And also just one point, the comment is really on implicit consultation. I'm trying to find out how far about you go. Where the public hearing for the only committee or just move on different provinces and so on. Of course, there are other measures to the transmission, but of course, the public hearing is where we can.
I was going to ask a few questions, but they've fallen away because of the questions asked by the members, that's apart from the DA, of course, were very good. So, you know, I don't know. Secondly, there was a request, to Momo and Yanga. There was a request by the trade unions and NGOs, I think, for the cluster of groups opposed to the CPs at all, for a more representative panel. They suggested names which I forwarded and asked previous consideration be given to, but you know, I noticed from the past part of them cannot subscribe to the executive. It's an executive structure that you establish. So we strongly suggested that you consider at least one of the two names if I recall. Secondly, I think the police has covered me. I want to know whether this panel will continue to do some work, and I hope Momo it would, so the question could be you. Thirdly, I think that I would like to know how the panel took final decisions, presumably some form of consensus, but if you could kindly explain to us. Then the next issue is, you said you went to Netherlands. Can you give us some sense of what came out of that more precisely, in some detail if possible, not too many details, but it's just what happened in Netherlands. Can I check, are there any representatives of the civil society organizations here who actually made submissions and or want to make, who are you representing, my friend? Yeah, you might want to say a few words as well. Okay, so you just signal to us how you feel. But maybe the panel wants to tell us what they understand the response of the people opposed to the increase is to their report. Then maybe especially while you've got actual written submissions, you might want to give us a quick overview without going through all the black copies of that. Then on the issue of sanitary pads, in Koleko, I think the issue there isn't simply about a cost saving to the lower income earners, even if it doesn't apply to the underclasses and the poorest of the poor. It's about gender equality. You and I don't use sanitary pads, but women are required by nature to do so. There are many progressive people who would argue that sanitary pads should be free in every society. Any civilized society would do that sort of possible argument. So it's also about fairness, gender equality, and human rights. It's not just about who benefits, and I agree with many of the things you say. For what it's worth, it's true that people who have suffered through their lived experiences, enormous deprivation, brutality, even dehumanization, bring enormous color and life and substance to decisions made by experts. So that's very, very important. But it's also true, I think, that people who have not experienced that can be very, very empathetic to those who have and can understand, even without having experienced that, what it means to the extent it's possible. Otherwise, you will not get middle-class people of whatever color identifying and immersing themselves in the struggles of the poor, disadvantaged riches of the earth. So, for example, little for what it's worth, maybe because I'm 62 and been around, there's very little you said to me I don't already know. If you've been around as long as I have been and you read novels written by people, you know, so I don't think that's a very strong argument here. It can be a very strong argument in other contexts. Like, for example, an African person saying, another black person, meaning so-called Indian or colored, will never experience what it meant. Well, colored people, I don't think it applies to them. Unless they're indigenous neighbors. But I understand that sort of, but the arguments used here, I don't think are compelling enough with due respect and political. We can have some discussion of life. But you are right to point to many of the things you do. My issue also is, and I'm sure it is with all of us, ultimately, no matter what the panel do, it's the executive that will come with its proposals, right? So, now you must remember, ultimately, no matter what you do, it's Parliament that will decide.
Yeah.
One of our members here has already said, and she's been quoted in the media, that this thing will only apply for a year. Another member has raised the question, saying he has, that actually can it apply just for a year? At this stage, while the ANC has not taken a final position, we are signaling to the executive at this stage, unless convinced otherwise, we feel that this must have a time frame. Am I right, members?
Yes, you are.
A time frame.
Yes.
In other words, it's not here forever. So it's for the executive to convince us that we shouldn't put a time frame in the rates and monetary bill and the related sections of the other two bills we got. So the issue really is the time frame. As Tali said today, which I think many of us will identify with, it's a particular fiscal crisis we're experiencing. And for that period, it may be unavoidable and inevitable, maybe, to have the VAT at 15%. Notwithstanding the many, many critiques, even from the left, even from a neo-Marxist lecturer who came here, right, who made this information, one of us, so to speak, right, who's been part of the movement, that actually the VAT is not regressive. And there are one or two other neo-Marxists or Marxists who say it. The fact is, we've been through that, and we say that in the real world out there, the other things I need to point out to members and to the people who are here, we were, I think, a bit surprised, to put it for one of the best ways, like that, that when the Reserve Bank governor came here, and he looked at the last quarter or last 2 quarters, I can't recall, inflation, the impact of the VAT increase at this stage was not obvious. He explained why, that there was a fall in the price of certain other commodities. But even then, his sense in reply to the questions I asked him specifically was, obviously the other two say, or the clairvoyant, his sense was, but it's very good, so it's not fine. His sense was that it's not likely to have a very big impact for this financial year. That took me by surprise and many others here. So, and looking at the, some of the statistics you provided here as well, although, as you rightly say, Professor, the amount of 105 may not seem a lot to something like Nazi's metal here, but it is a very significant percentage of its former constituents, you know. But still, I'm a bit surprised, and it's nearly 105, that it's 105. I somehow imagine it to be higher. All of which is not to say we're detracting from the position of the study group. But actually, that's another reason why, instead of taking final decision on the eve of the end of our five-year term, this committee might be wise to put a time frame and ask for a review. Which is to say that we would like the economy to grow, we'd like illicit financial flows to be tackled, we'd like money to be saved, not least by the parliament, let alone the executive and the department. We welcome what Ayanda Korla said recently about ministers' trouble, but even at the parliament. And some of it is beginning to happen as chairs, you will see. Tandy may know some of this. What I'm saying in short, colleagues, is that we must actually signal to the executive now that they need to respond to the report sympathetically. It's a good report, because they can reject everything, right? And that they must also understand that at this stage, unless we are convinced otherwise, we want to insert a time frame. Over then to the colleagues from the panel and then Treasury.
Chair,
yeah, my brother, yeah.
Chair, I do not mean to interrupt your sequence. But,
no, that's fine.
I would hate, Chair, to be misunderstood,
yeah,
as I think I have. And I will reiterate the point I was making. The issue is, for the purposes of this exercise,
yeah,
I do not believe that the argument to say zero rate addresses the issue of free sanitary time. I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
So what? So that's what I was trying to make. So I
that's not the only consideration.
No. I understand, Chair, and in other platforms I'm on, fully on record to say sanitary towers must be free. I'm unapologetic about that. But what I'm saying is, in this instance,
yes,
the argument made was that the relief of the zero rating would be for the higher end of the spectrum. And the point I'm coming from is that my understanding is that this intervention of zero rating must, in the immediate, address the collective interests of the poor, which is the end of the spectrum.
Yes.
That's all I was saying.
Yeah,
so,
no, in fact, what you're saying,
so I just wanted to clear the air in that regard, Chairperson.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No. I think we agree. We just
Sure. Technically
from different vantage points. Good. Okay. Thank you. Over to the team. Yes, my friend, where are you from?
The Chair, I'm from the Fair Play Movement, and I just wanted to check at what point would you give civil society a chance to input.
Well, I think we should just let it now. Let's input. Because remember, we have a proper hearing.
This is you click comrades will address your question.
No. Are you agreeable? We just take a 5-minute input from each other and you respond to everything. And then we draw to a close. Because really, this is our first consideration collectively. Right? And we will need Zakele and Antonia and so on to do the work on this thing now and prepare a report. But we're going to move swiftly. Right? Time is fast running out to finish our bill. Yes, my friend from Justice Coalition.
Mr. Chairman, how many people are going to contribute? At 5 minutes each, how much time?
Just two of them.
Just two, thank you.
It just assists the process. So the signal to us where they are.
I want to say thank you to the expert panel for the work. We are cognizant that the timing was quite quick that they had to work in. And I think that would be a first point for us, is that the timing in terms of against the poor and against consideration while other things continue to go on, and that point about the distraction that happens and the cost of what is happening in the country seems to be borne by the poor. And so there's this revolving question for us in civil society of when you have to participate in the fiscal framework, participation process, because it always seems the time is against us. And then just to ask specific questions of clarity around the child support grant recommendation of 240 rand, that's on top of the inflationary increase, the same recommendation. And then also around the early childhood development sector and feeding schemes for children under 5, how those recommendations would work out.
I just want to make two comments, or a third one. The one is that we would make a submission in the next round of the process. But first, we are disappointed that we are disappointed with the outcome of the process. We are also of the opinion that one of the TORs were not met by the last panel of experts, and that is that they did not reconsider the old list, and it did not take into account dietary changes, consumer preferences over the last 27 years, etc. And then the last one is that we do not think that the basket speaks, or the basket as proposed, speaks to the nutritional needs of society as it is currently. And the exclusion of chicken based on particular arguments that are actually working or that were in favor of the inclusion of others do not make sense and are at times even illogical. So those are the three inputs that I would like to get some.
Yeah, okay, you can write to us immediately, both of you, because the sooner you do so, the better. Did you make a submission to the final report?
Yes.
It's the same submission you bring into Parliament, right?
No.
Oh, you're going to add something. All right, have you, my friend, submitted a reply now to the final report of Parliament to National Treasury?
We're working on that.
Okay. All right. Good. All right, fine. Head over to the team. Let's start with your team, Ingrid.
Right, so I'll start, which gives me the opportunity to choose which questions I'll respond to. So thank you so much. That was, I think all the questions were incredibly useful to us, and I think there's a huge amount of agreement between the honourable members and the panel, so that's comforting. I mean, perhaps we can start by just getting clarity on the numbers, because I know there was some confusion, particularly from the DA on the numbers.
No, that wasn't too much confusion.
I'm from the committee.
You are always...
No. She doesn't speak for the committee, good.
just to be clear...
I don't wear a DA badge here.
Sorry. I think Mr. Mania raised some questions about the numbers.
And I did too.
So...
Okay, enough banter. The chair.
No,
it's
because she
said
it's
a question. The chair
is a question.
Nobody
else can do it. The DA is confused, and that's what it is.
I think we've got to be clear in how we communicate. So the increase, and I don't want us to get into a back and forth between the panel and the Treasury today. Yes, at some point that will need to happen. So that I'm aware of the fact that the Treasury is concerned that they think our numbers might be on the low side. That is possible. But if our numbers are on the low side, then they are consistently on the low side. So therefore, what I mean by that is, it would mean that when we estimate the loss to the fiscus, we might be slightly underestimating, but therefore we are also underestimating the impact that the VAT increase had on households. So we need to be consistent. If we think that the numbers are coming out of the living conditions survey are underestimates, then they are underestimates across the board, and we need to upweight everywhere. But okay, let's for the meantime stay with the numbers that are in the report. So we estimate that the impact of the 1% VAT increase on the poorest 50% of households is about 1.8 billion rand. Okay, so let's remember that 1.8 billion. If we look at the poorest 70% of households, the impact is about 3.1 billion. So there were a few questions about, well, how did we think about what sort of size of impact did we want to try to mitigate? So certainly we were thinking that we were working in that frame. We want to try and at least ensure that the mitigation to poorer households is of that sort of order of magnitude. So the items that we suggest, we estimate that about 2.8 billion would be returned to those bottom seven deciles. So the bottom seven deciles would be paying 3.1 billion extra in VAT, but through the additional zero rating, 2.8 billion would be returned to those households. So it's not perfect. Of course, some households will not get the full benefit, but that was the sort of way that we approached it. Very much appreciated the point about how do we make the tax system as a whole more progressive. And so I think we have quite a lot of evidence that some of the tax handles are highly progressive. So the personal income tax system, in the personal income tax system, for example, the richest decile is paying about 87% of personal income tax, so a highly, highly progressive tax. Some of the other tax handles, if you think about the excise duty, is a regressive tax. The fuel levy is almost a neutral tax. It is not a progressive tax. We know that. We know that the poor pay fuel levy via prices and directly through transport. So there are different. So when has these different tax handles, and what one, the important thing is to ensure that the system as a whole is progressive. So I think some of the comments we got on the expenditure side are very well taken. I think we were clear that we were a tax panel. It's not, it simply wasn't feasible for us to think about how do we reimagine the whole fiscal system to make the fiscal system more progressive and more pro-poor. And I think perhaps, if I can completely overstep my mandate, I think this committee, this parliamentary committee, might want to ask for a new panel to be constituted to specifically look at how do we make fiscal policy more pro-poor, and how do we now take that forward and think about how do we start to make all these fiscal puzzles fit together in a pro-poor way. I think it wasn't just about a time constraint. I think it's about a capacity issue within this panel. I don't think we have a war room on poverty. I don't think we're going to start to reimagine all those government policies. But that's not to say that there shouldn't be a springboard for that to happen. Let me clarify that the issue about white bread, brown bread. So just to be clear, brown bread is already zero rated. So it's certainly not that we're suggesting that people should switch to eating white bread or that white bread should be privileged over brown bread. The point that the Department of Health made to us is that there is a lack of availability of brown bread in some areas. And so they work on, and particularly that there's a lack of availability of brown bread flour. So they said in deep rural areas, they're aware of the fact that many households bake their own bread and that they're using white bread flour or white cake flour in order to do that. And so the Department of Health were in fact the people who brought this particular proposal of zero rating white bread, which might seem surprising from a nutritional point of view, but the Department of Health were clear that they can legislate fortification of white bread flour and white bread loaves in order to ensure that nutritionally it's not that much worse. And at the same time, they would see their role as being on the education side to promote better eating, better styles of eating. But certainly not to try and switch consumers from brown bread to white bread. That was not the intention. An honourable member raised the issue about should we not have a much broader definition and let's just include all bread. Well, that's a choice that society and Parliament as representative society needs to make. Doesn't want to think about your sort of real speciality breads. You want, you know,
gluten-free
cranberry bread, you know, potato bread. You know, that is a decision. It's of course, as you broaden the definition, then the amount of tax leakage becomes bigger. And so the recommendation that SARS made in this regard is that they say that it is actually quite easy to define what is a conventional 700-gram loaf of bread. And that their suggestion was that one limits in that way, because that is the bread that is more often consumed by poorer households than these sort of, you know, more luxury rye breads, you know, low GI breads, etc. But of course, that is a decision that could be made. There's a question about the methodology and the 66 items. So perhaps to clarify that, so we used the microdata from the Living Conditions Survey, which contains 760 expenditure items. When we say we looked at the 66 items, what we did there was to ensure that the 66 items that had been raised through the 2000 submission, that those were analyzed. But in reality, all 760 items were analyzed. Right? So we're happy to share the spreadsheet. And the analysis, so all 760 items were analyzed, but we took a more careful look at the 66 items that had come up through the submissions just to see if there were examples where perhaps one of those items passed three of the four numerical tests, but maybe not all of them. We took a closer look at those 66 items. But in reality, all of those 66 items were already items that we would have looked at in any event, given that we were looking at it more complex. So just
to add on to that, I mean, there are various, we've got many spreadsheets on how we looked at all the items, and we didn't just consider the submissions, and just by the way, the submissions, some of them were incredibly well-researched submissions, so we did consider them quite closely, and some of them obviously we felt that these were companies that were trying to promote their products. But in the main, we did, you know, we did look at everything, and we looked at what the poor consumed, and we focused on the poor and the lower deciles when deciding what products we need to look at. And just holistic, you know, I get a sense that there's an expectation that we were supposed to solve all societal ills in terms of affordability, and we weren't. We were obviously going to, I mean, our mission was to cushion the poor against the VAT increase, and we stuck to that mandate. So yes, we can argue, why did you not include chicken? Chicken costs just, you know, 5.6 billion. So the VAT foregone from the budget would be about 5.6 billion. And we need to also, I mean, as we're moving things along, and I say, you know, this is the revenue and this is the zero rating. When you move products from this side to now the zero rating, you're leaving a hole in the revenue. So we also had to balance that and think, okay, what are we, you know, what if we're moving chicken to the zero rated side, what does it mean to the fiscus? How are we going to fill that hole? And then we don't want to put that burden on the treasury to now have to increase VAT or increase personal income tax because they're trying to fill a hole that is already currently 58 billion in deficit. So we were very cognizant. It was a very tight balancing act, but we had to do it nonetheless. Just, I know we've spoken about sanitary towels, but so the reason why, just to also expand on your question on, you know, if it doesn't really, why zero rated if it won't benefit the people that are supposed to benefit. We had this discussion about, and right at the end of the report, and we thought, what products or, you know, do men use or have to use because nature determines them to use it? That is, that has a VAT on it. So, you know, we felt that the sanitary towels were a grudge tax on all women. And so that's why we decided to zero rate it. But then we further went, you know, zero rating it over again. We said, okay, but it doesn't really help the people that we were supposed to help. We further then recommended to government to provide it for free. And we already know that there are administrative issues. We know that the KZN has, it was well reported, where there were issues there. So it is really up to the government to support this recommendation to zero rate and also to provide it to the poor. And I think we are limited in terms of how we can, you know, in suggesting how it should be done. There are various ways. It can be hospitals and public departments. But that's really up to the government to decide on that. On Brazil and Cuba, you're right that, you know, they do have quite interesting ways of looking at targeted ways to deal with taxes and the poor and health issues. And again, we felt that this is outside a little bit of our scope. So I looked at Brazil in terms of an alternative, and Brazil does have a card, by the way. So they do have a card, and something where I actually spoke to certain banks to ask them, how feasible would this be? Would this have to be aligned to a SASA card, or would we have to have a different type of card that would restrict what you're saying? It's almost like the NSF card. Instead of having the food stamp, which the U.S. guys have, because with food stamps, what I researched is that the poor would then sell their food stamps to those who can afford in exchange for money. Mm. And so you don't want that. The reason why we want a targeted way of purchasing food is because you want that nutrition. You want to force parents or the poor to purchase certain products. But again, it's administrative issues that I think the government would have to look into. You know, with the school uniforms, It would be very easy to administer this if we had a national public school uniform.
Yeah.
Many African countries have this, where certain schools in different provinces would have, let's say, a maroon uniform with a light pink shirt, or a green uniform with a light green shirt, and a dress that has a particular color. So then we can be very specific in terms of the rating. Tax policy, we also have to work within tax policy. Tax policies, we looked at the three E's. It has to be equity, so it has to be equitable. There's also ease of administration and efficiency. So we were also guided by that when we were looking at products to use. So we had the SARS specialist who helped us in terms of ease of administration. So there are lots of products that we did look at. But when we looked at the administration of it, it was virtually impossible. The definitions would have to go into legal issues, and it just made it very difficult to reserve certain products that, because of the administration was not easy. So take for instance chicken. Chicken was a big debate. I mean, it's interesting that a lot of what you have mentioned is exactly what we mentioned as a committee. And the discussion was robust. The discussion was very stressful and heated. And so it wasn't easy to come up with the items that we recommended. Chicken, for instance, we thought not only the cost to the fiscus, but then if we had to do the quick frozen pieces, what's stopping, these are the discussions that we had, what's stopping KFC, for instance, or Chicken Licking or Nando's from buying their chicken from Spar or Checkers or Pick and Pay that is zero rated? But we can't also determine them, we can't force them to change their prices. They may not change their prices when they, at the consumer level, when they sell these chicken pieces. So those are the things which also I think are something that government should look at, because there are also market structures that are preventing, for instance, the zero rating from being passed down to consumers, and making it also very difficult to, which prevented us from, this was part of the discussions that we had in terms of how do we do this? What prevent, there's market structures, there's market manipulation. Do we include the Competition Commission when we have these discussions? And I think that's something that the members of this committee may have to consider. And Ingrid, Professor Ingrid did speak about the bread, fortification of white bread, which is very important, because if you fortify white bread, you're including things like iron, folic acid, which help with birth defects and also lowers heart problems. So it is important to fortify, and there is a nutritional value in fortifying white bread. The other thing that we found with white bread is that it is consumed in many areas more than brown bread. We looked, yes. I also didn't expect that. I argued against it. I said, no, that's not possible. But then actually when we started speaking to a lot of people, and also data showed us that white bread in many areas is consumed. It tastes better. It absorbs, the goddamn stuff. Mm. It absorbs, like in a bunny chow too, you use the same flour to make maguenya. So it absorbs sauces and meats and stuff better than brown bread. So it is preferred by the poor. We also tend to think that the poor are not aspirational. So the poor have aspirations. So they will choose a product that they prefer, that tastes better, that looks better. So they're not, down and out and would eat, products that are not tasty. And I think from a taste perspective, white bread, fortunately, tastes better than brown bread. On to nappies, I looked at the research on nappies. So, just like, I guess it's the same as sanitary towels. Nappies, women, a lot of poor women work. A lot of poor women do not have time to wash cloth nappies. Yes, there's a huge, if you look at literature, it is. And if you look at literature on nappies, I mean, I looked at everything from, I was joking with the guys, there's dog nappies in South Africa, all the way to astronaut nappies. The astronauts use nappies when they are sent up to, so they can't follow me. So nappies are... Nappies, yes, from an environment, if you look at literature, it all talks about, and especially overseas, it talks about the environmental problems, issues with nappies.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are other environmental issues that are very real in our context. The health issues that are related to cloth nappies are massive. Mm. Because if you don't have water, because they need water to wash, if you don't have water, it infects the child. So children have diseases because of cloth nappies that are not washed properly. The other thing is that, yes, we can't punish, so we can't look at environmental issues now, because we're hoping that as a country, as we develop, some of these issues like the environment, affordability, will subside. So even with the poor, I'm not hoping that we're talking about the poor and these products, and what this discussion that we're having, I'm hoping that in 10, 15 years' time, some of these people are out of poverty, that we don't have an issue with refuse collection, because we would have a system that collects nappies even in the villages that currently don't have refuse collection. So again, it's a government, it has to be seen holistically in a holistic approach in this. We can't punish poor people because of, you know, environmental issues now, because there's no refuse collection, and as we know, the last time we had this exercise was in 1993. We're hoping that in the next couple of years that refuse issue will be dealt with. I think Ingrid did speak about the methodology. When we started, when we were selected for this panel, there was an email from civil society to Treasury about certain members of the committee who they felt that wouldn't represent the poor. I was one of those members who was assumed to not represent the poor, so I took it very personally. So I took it very personally, only because I understood why VAT had to be increased. And I wrote a lot about it in the papers about why we needed to increase VAT from a fiscal perspective. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that I'm insensitive to the plight of the poor. And I then took it upon myself, and I think maybe a little bit of me wanted to deal with that issue, to contact every single NGO I could think of in the country. So when you were asked, somebody asked about how inclusive was this consultation. So everyone, I emailed, even, you know, KZN, Eastern Cape, called them. Some of them we didn't meet, but we did email, and they did send their submissions. We did come to Cape Town to meet with a few. We were in Joburg as well, and I think there's one in Stellenbosch. And so we did try to reach out to a lot of people in South Africa beyond the NEDLAG process. And what was interesting is I learned a lot from that process. A lot of the NGOs who represent the poor, by the way, are not poor, are not black. Many of them are white. But they deal with the issues of, they deal with the poor, and directly, to the extent where that I didn't know, for instance, that 8% or more than 8% of South African kids are stunted. And this is the information that I got from the engagement that we had with NGOs that deal with the poor. So I think you're right, Chen, in terms of, you know, there's an assumption that because you look a certain way, you may not understand the poor, but I think that as a black person, and I think all black people have had either directly, indirectly, families who are poor, currently poor, you understand the poor, but I still learned a lot from those who are seen to be, you know, some white members of the NGOs who deal with the poor and who gave me information that I wasn't aware of. So I think that that engagement was very interesting, and we did try to speak to as many people as possible. Somebody else, how did the panel take, you know, the final decision? We argued. We argued. There were more, some panel members who were more impatient, some were more understanding, some were leftist, some were center-left. It was exactly the way, you know, Parliament happens. And I think it's important because these discussions are emotive, are robust, and I think that we wouldn't have gotten to writing such a comprehensive report had we not had that engagement. So after all of that, we decided we had to come to an agreement. We were taught to come to an agreement, and this was the we all agreed on these recommendations and suggestions. I think I'll leave it to Ayabonga.
Yeah, I guess I have the fortune of having most of the things covered. So let me maybe start off from Kulebo with your question around school uniforms. Because there's often the question of what is the frequency of households buying school uniforms. There's an interesting graph in our report. It's on page... Let me just say it's figure 3. I don't have the right page numbers here. But if there's any one graph in the report that I think illustrates the kind of income inequality that we have in our country, it's this graph. Because for me, the question of frequency also needs to be asked alongside the distribution of income in the society. That's page 17, huh?
Yeah.
Now, why do I say that? If we assume, Member Nati made the point, that all of us would go to PEP and get a student print shirt. Now, that shirt is a certain proportion of the household income for a household in decile 9, which would be different to a household in decile 2. Now, if I'm in decile 2, or even right up to decile 7, that's a big ticket item, irrespective of whether I buy it once in a year. And what makes it even worse is that it's a big ticket item that comes just off of the back of the December rush, where in all likelihood I've been traveling either between Johannesburg and whatever labor sending area I come from. Now, that's one example. But let me just to reinforce the point, because I think it's also helpful for our consideration of the sanitary towel intervention as well. If you look at decile 7, now numerically one would think that if you are closer to number 10, that at least you have a bigger chunk of the income. But let's look at those figures. 2014 and 15, your average annual income if you are in decile 7 was 104,600. Now if you take that to a monthly figure, at a household level, you're sitting just over 8,700. Now, for all intents and purposes, I wouldn't say, but the kind of dependency ratios that we have in this country, that 8,700 rand makes you really, really rich. And so the question for me around school uniforms is about saying, how do you cushion the impact, least of all for the big ticket items, where the assumption is at a lower end of the distribution, for all intents and purposes, there are many more children of school-going age who would need this kind of uniform. And I hope maybe that's a helpful consideration that also informs how we approach the sanitary pads one, because I do agree with the chair that the consideration also ought to be from a grudge tax and a gender justice perspective, but also not to see these interventions in isolation. Just like I said, no one in decile 7 would shout off the rooftops and say that they're rich. Rich enough for them not to warrant whatever relief would be given on the taxation side of things, least of all for something like a sanitary towels, which is not something that you ideally would have wanted to happen for you. It's just, you know, by accident of birth and something that is naturally occurring. I also want to touch maybe on the issue of the nappies, and I recall when we had this conversation. It was on a very tense call. As Tabi was saying, many of the deliberations were very tense within the panel. But when the issue of cloth nappies was raised, now one of the important things, and the chair mentioned it, is that, you know, if you come from a certain lived experience, you tend to ask certain different questions about these things. If you take cloth nappies, for instance, the question then becomes, what do you zero rate? Do you zero rate the cloth, speliti, Vaseline, and all manner of other things you would have to use, and the whites and all manner of other things. And if you do so, for what end? But also, there's a certain assumption that we're making, that people would have the time to go and wash these things, that there would be someone who's providing the labor to wash it. Now, in many instances in the rural areas, you find yourself in a situation where you can't be assured of that labor. Least of all, if you think about child-headed households, if you're thinking about households where there's a huge generational gap, there's a grandmother and then there's the children, and of course those people in the middle are either in the cities working or worst yet have passed on. So I think for me those are some of the considerations that we ought to consider, least of all when we propose the cloth nappies as an alternative. I think the other issue is that people use both. If I know I'm going to be in the house for most of the day, likelihood is that I'm going to use the cloth nappy. But if I have to be on the move, as you would expect people to be, then of course the disposable nappy gives you the kind of convenience, because you don't have to now stop and wash the thing again and still pin your neck and then still be able to do all manner of other things. I want to maybe, and I know my colleagues have already touched on the methodological issues, safe to say that we weren't just reliant on the public submissions to arrive at the 66 goods in this instance. And I must say that there are certain goods in our analysis of the entire universe that is in the Living Conditions Survey that, from just off the bat, would go off the list. If you look at cigarettes, for instance, if you look at snaf, if you look at beer, all of those things, yes, would emerge methodologically from the test, because you find that lower income households spend a disproportionate amount of their income on those goods. But we can't make the case for zero rating of some of those goods. Nor did any of the submissions that we received make that kind of case. The other question I wanted to touch on, and I think Tabi has gone to some length, just on the school uniforms, I think we ought to consider that there is already a process in the Competition Commission that is looking at this issue, least of all from a market structure perspective and some of the exclusive agreements that exist between certain retailers and certain schools. And I think in most instances, that would be a consideration at the top end of the income distribution, where you're talking about former Model C schools, private schools, and the like. But if you look at many of the schools that service low-income communities, you would find that you're not going to find all of these trappings that you would find, for instance, in a Model C school. You're not going to get a basher, you're not going to get a scarf, you're not going to get a very nice blazer, you're not going to get all of those things. And I think, to some extent, that does serve to offset some of the definitional issues. Because one of the debates we had within the panel was to say there must be certain goods in a school uniform package that all of us would see as very affluent. I mean, a blazer with three buttons and looking very nice, I mean, surely that won't go into an elementary and a rudimentary package. And I think the suggestion that my colleague Tabu was making, I think, is a relevant one, because you do see it across the continent where there's at least a base line of common uniform that ties across the board. If I can comment briefly just on the consultations, least of all within NEDLAC, we did get an opportunity to interact with all of the different chambers within NEDLAC, business, labor, community, and the government. And I recall Chris did make a presentation at one of those sessions. So we were able to get submissions from labor, and much of the submissions were also very similar to the submissions that have already been placed in the parliamentary process, save for a few changes here and there. We did also, as Tabi alluded, reach out to members of the Budget Justice Coalition, who probably the widest cross-section of NGOs that have made submissions to this particular process. We did also reach out to people who are outside of NEDLAC. And it's unfortunate that some of them weren't able, within our allocated time, to make the written submissions. And one that comes to mind in that instance is the South African Federation of Trade Unions, and unfortunately they weren't able to make a submission to this particular panel. They had made a submission initially to parliamentary processes around this, and they did indicate to us that those submissions in principle wouldn't be radically different to what they've submitted. I don't know if I've covered all of the questions. Of course there might still be other questions that might emerge. And thank you very much, Chair.
Yeah, in case you need, I'm sure some of you are new here. I'm actually multitasking, right? and I have to do some stuff related to tomorrow's meeting, so I don't need to do it from a good perspective. You can challenge me on whether I follow what you said outside this meeting. But that also means that if I wasn't typing and SMSing, it doesn't mean I'm necessarily follow everything you said, because I don't actually.
Sure.
And obviously, Tandis are experts.
Check in the speech at one. I have not started my speech.
Sorry?
Can you finish at one, please?
Yeah, no, in fact, if you hadn't spoken for 17 minutes, I was going to finish a few minutes earlier. It's only 12:23. It's a courtesy that I have to express, because suddenly I've got a brilliant thing surfacing now about tomorrow's meeting.
Yes.
Who's going to deal with it? When? You have to deal with it now. Right. Now, and you know what I'm talking about also. Already there's a whole thing about youth strategy. Now, the thing I want to say, my friend, is that Treasury hasn't responded. We may have to call you back again. In fact, we would like you to be here when the civil society comes within the next 2 weeks. We have to negotiate a date. Time's fast running out. Parliament's got a very short term this quarter. But we also say that, look, I really think listening to you, both in your initial input and responses, probably the majority, if not all of us, would say whether we agree or disagree with you, within a month, I think all of us are saying this, almost all, if not all, you've done a very good job. What's also very interesting to most, if not all of us here, is that young people, new people who are surfacing, people one-third my age. So for people of my age, if you don't present yourself as a youth, I don't know enough about these issues, right? But the people who are here are world class, actually.
Yes,
and it's inspiring.
Especially
when you look at the young people, right? Who are here.
Yes.
I'm not saying that you're not young. Very encouraging. Right? Okay. Having said that,
very
more, now I refer to a generation that he and I, and this elite, and maybe not, who knows, we're not talking about us now. We the has-beens, right? Or near has-beens. Okay, Momo.
Jim,
you want to raise something? Yeah.
There are a couple of questions that weren't answered.
All right, but
I think some might be National Treasury.
Yeah.
But the one question that I think should be answered is the question of the existing deteriorated items.
Yeah.
And what process you followed not to come to any recommendation. Or why it didn't come to. And then you say there's some sort of difference of opinion about cost, but you haven't expressed an opinion then or a calculation of what the total cost of your recommendations would be. You replied to my question about the 3.1 billion versus the 2.8 billion, but not the total cost of the package as you recommended. And then probably, Mr. Chairman, I think Moira will now deal with the life of the panel and the cost of the panel.
So Chair, I'm happy to very quickly talk about the existing 19 items. So it's quite remarkable that given that there was very little science that went into that original list in the early 90s of the 19 items, it turns out to be an incredibly good list. And there's been lots of research over the last 20 years of analyzing those items. So that original graph that we showed on slide 8, where we look at what is the incidence of the existing current deteriorated items on slide 8. So it turns out that the current list
page
is,
four.
Oh, they've got the different versions.
Okay.
So the existing list serves us very well. We did touch on the fact that we didn't have the data to drill down into these rare fruits, right? The kiwi fruits. Oh, and you've got green fruits on your plate. The data just doesn't. The conditions survey interviews 30,000 households. You just don't get enough of that highly detailed, reliable data when it comes to fruits and vegetables that are not frequently consumed. So we talk in the report about the fact that not only did we not have the data to drill down into the specific fruits and vegetables, but the Department of Health also expressed the view that they were concerned that if we start a narrative around the fact
that poor people only eat four or five vegetables and maybe, you know, a few fruits, that from a health promotion perspective, they were uncomfortable with this idea that we start to say, let's take some fruit and vegetables off of it. But for this, as a whole, serves us incredibly well. So that, you know, that, so that is a starting point there to say that actually the current items are incredibly good choices, and that none of the items that we're adding turn out to be better choices than what's currently on the list. And that's what I thought was looking for. In terms of the cost of the total package, so if I understand, so the items that we suggest adding, the cost would be $4.1 billion, right? If you're saying what would the cost be of the expenditure side proposal, we're very clear that we made some suggestions for the expenditure side. We did not make recommendations other than on sanitary towels. None of what we suggest are, you know, this is over coming up. But the panel didn't feel competent to do that on the expenditure side. I hope that's clarified.
All right, shall we move on then to
Chair, I think let me just start by saying, just complimenting, I think, the panel. I mean, they worked, as you know, in a very short time.
Yeah.
And I think whatever they were going to present, there's no way they were going to satisfy everyone. And I think we must thank them, I think, for the work that they put in, and I think also for pointing out things that they couldn't do, just given the time. So, and so I think they've been perfectly open and transparent about their report, and not their limitations, but the limitations given the short time, and the complexity of the issue. Just to say, you know, they also came very cheap.
What?
I don't have the. I don't.
Not
why?
Not cheap.
No. And I'm saying this because I think that they showed. I think they showed incredible commitment, and I think
yeah.
we must thank them for it. Okay. So, you know, I don't have the figure. We'll get the figure. You know, but it.
But for now, we'll.
It will shock you how cheap
it
was. So I want to thank them. I think they.
I was.
It demonstrates their commitment.
They used in the 20
Oh, here we go.
And if you take the chair, they didn't even meet. They had lots of tele. Conferences and so on. So I think you just note that. So I only say that because I think they showed incredible commitment and they do need to be thanked for that. I think, Chair, too, I just want to raise a broader point. We're not obviously going to comment today on the responses. I think it's just fair we wait for all the comments to come in and then we look at it with an open mind. But let me just say, you know, I think the bigger issue for the VAT issue, you know, aside from it being a blunt instrument, is really that how do we monitor that the programs we have in government that are there to assist poor communities, make sure people aren't in poverty, why are they working, and can we have a more effective mechanism where, you know, you've got to say a school nutrition program. Is it actually working? Is it feeding the kids? It may well be. I'm only raising the question because, you know, and if it was working, it's a very effective mechanism. And if it's not working, you know, can we have systems in government to solve the problem within days and not wait for a big commission of inquiry? Because often you find that it may be a program and then it gets stuck in tender issues and everybody else wants their cut and actually children don't get fed. So, you know, sometimes I think, and I'm being out of order, do we need a permanent poor commission which is sitting and looking at anywhere in the country, if a program is not working, as parliament or legislature or municipality said it should, that they have intrusive powers to direct, okay, and make sure the program works and so on. I think that's what we need to do. And at the heart of those issues is accountability around programs. that if there's no accountability and people are stealing or they're not directing properly or they're uncaring public servants, you know, these things don't work, and I think we need to be pretty brutal when programs don't work to make sure they're working. So I do think that, I think all the NGOs that have come, I think that they really do mean well, and they are acting in the interests of poor communities, and I think we must salute them for that. And that's why it's so hard to differ on these issues. The problem is the state does need revenue. And, you know, we don't want to mislead anybody. The VAT increase is going to be here for a while. It's not a one-year matter. The money that we need to look at the fiscal envelope is actually required, firstly, at least over the MTEF. And the reality is this, that unless expenditure is going to come down drastically, that it's not likely, and we get growth. It would be really good if we can get economic growth. And if you remember, most years after 94, the tax proposals used to be, we bring down personal income tax, we bring down corporate income tax, etc. Unfortunately, we're not there. And you can see over the next 3 to 5 years, we're not going to be there. And so you do hope that at some point, we get back to the times when we are reducing the major taxes. Okay? I'm talking of the big 3 or 4 taxes. The one problem you do have with that, and you know, we met with some experts from the OECD, they say when you reduce VAT, and it's not a South African phenomenon, all the reduction, once you have it, almost all the reduction is then absorbed by others. It doesn't actually... I was asked a question. Is it reversible? I'm saying legally, obviously, anything is reversible. But let me just say that when we put the fiscal framework, we are looking at it over a few years. Okay. And
yeah, that's all you
need. And okay.
Let's follow the
decide. That's fine.
Today I want to stop him, Chair. Okay.
Who stopped you?
I hate being the messenger of bad news. But anyway, has the panel's life come to an end?
Yeah.
It has come to an end. Because, I mean, they've delivered on the specific mandate, and I think, Chair, as you outlined, once the public comments come in, obviously the Minister of Finance will have to, as we do normally, we'll have a response document, and I think if the President last week mentioned that the Cabinet will also want to look at the proposal,
yes,
before we come up with the bill. With the final proposal. So that's the process that we have. Chair, the other questions you asked, we did address them when there was concerns on the composition and so on the panel. We did change the terms of reference quite significantly because there were issues on the fiscal framework.
Yeah, no, in fact, I remember that, yeah.
And I think we did say that the names were presented, we didn't want the group also to be seen to be lobbying for any specific view, corrective or whatever the view is. Yeah, in terms of NEDLAC, I think we've said there was a hearing. NEDLAC's very clear that, you know, they all expressed their views. There was no process to get a final NEDLAC position, but there was a presentation where they expressed their views and members of the panel were there. As you know. I don't know if I've left out anything.
About
the
yes, figures. No, thanks, Chair. In my other life in this Parliament, I serve on SCOPA. So I just, DDG, please, in your written responses, how much did you budget for this commission? Maybe that will help us. And how much did you spend? And how much was spent on remuneration? So we get the full picture as to what actually went into it. Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Lee, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just the first of all, I was indicated that the figures are
consistent, but perhaps low. What are your guys' figures? I mean, how much? Is this double what they're looking at in terms of the actual cost?
I think, look, when we respond, we do, I don't have a figure now, but we do check anyone's figures,
yeah,
even if it was in this
yeah,
panel,
yeah,
okay,
yeah.
To see whether we, you know, what's our view on their figures, we'll get, you know, we'll obviously use similar sources, but, you know, so we'll deal with that. We also will be checked, just so that you know, be meeting with other departments, because the way the panel has framed it, if you look at the issue of school uniforms, you'll meet with basic education, health, although they had a representative who was there, but when they were members of the panel, they were there in their individual capacity, even though they were representing, say, what health policy is. But we'd officially go to health and say, what's your thoughts on white bread? Okay. So that they would look at that as well. So, you know, those are the, and we'll go to SARS. Because ultimately the issue is, you know, given the administrative capacity and so on, are there any issues when you have zero rating and so on white bread, for example? Because I don't think, you know, it depends on, is it just a certain type of white bread? Is it all white bread? And I think Professor Woolard has said, what, the potato bread and all of those may also be white bread.
Okay,
to
be done,
for the purpose of record, because it's been 2 months, I did not realize that Momo is going to switch to becoming a full-time mathematician at a strategic point where we discuss the strategic matters. I request you to make a summary about the view and the position of the committee in relation to how we're going to look at the implementation of the EEC moving forward.
Where?
No, Chair, there's record.
No, you can summarize it.
No, Chair, I'm saying in terms of record, we have not yet come to a point where we've concluded what we're going to implement, because this will go into public discourse. There are people who are already campaigning here, and we don't want to find out.
Yeah, well, look, basically, I understand what
campaigning who? Campaigning who?
That we urge National Treasury to give serious consideration to the recommendations of the panel. We, at this stage, have not come to any conclusion about our own views on these recommendations. We wait to hear from civil society, both in terms of representation to National Treasury and the further representation that they would make to our committee very shortly. The committee at this stage, unless it is presented with a convincing argument by the executive otherwise, believes that there must be a time frame on the VAT increase. And we take into account there are several other considerations: economic growth, the need to contain expenditure within the state, not least Parliament, the need to extract from those who are responsible for illicit financial flows the monies that are due to the fiscus, and a variety of other attempts to get growth and job creation. Isn't that what we basically said?
Yes, Chair.
Good, thank you very much.
We will take, we will take.
You're recording it.
The time frame
of all your recording, right, did you? Because, Devon, hello? You're recording
all right. Did you say she? Time frame of 5 minutes. Time frame of 5 years. That's it, dude.
Can I see the
5 years?
Gracias.